Did you read the book?
Today in Studio 360.
What's wrong with reading books?
It used to be the big chain bookstores were feared and loathed by the old-fashioned little independent booksellers.
We're going to seduce them with our square footage, our discounts, and our deep armchairs, and our cappuccino.
Now bookstores of every size are discombobulated by the sudden dawning of the e-book age.
Grandpa, what's a bookstore?
It will be an event space with books as a nostalgic backdrop for people to browse through and not buy.
And we've sent a delegate to America's annual National Groovy People Convention, South by Southwest in Austin, where searching for the next big band is a proverbial needle in the haystack thing. But we think we may have found a needle. His name is Gary Clark Jr. That and lots more is ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the redesigned Scion TC, featuring a 180-horsepower engine and responsive handling, giving you the power to maneuver today's congested cities. Get there at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today, we get a lesson on songwriting from Randy Newman.
I sit at the piano and wait to have an idea. I'll play something. They'll give me, short people got no reason to live. For some reason, that's where I'll go.
Right.
But it'll always be music first.
And we'll find out how bookstores are planning to survive in this new age of e-books. But first, a look at how nonprofit theater companies around the country are surviving in this era of deep government cutbacks. So here's a question. Are there too many little theater companies in America? That was the shocking suggestion recently from the National Endowment for the Arts chair, Rocco Landisman. A big Broadway producer before he became the government's art czar, Landisman said, quote, "Demand is not going to increase. So it is time to think about decreasing supply."
The minute that he said that, of course, there was live blogging and tweeting going on in that room. And so that word just hit the internet. And suddenly people were talking about artistic death panels.
Scott Walters is a drama professor who runs an organization in Asheville, North Carolina, that's trying to bring theater back to rural America. And unlike a lot of his theater world peers, he welcomed the inconvenient conversation that Landisman launched.
Because I tend to agree with what it is that he's saying. But in a lot of ways, the increase in the number of theater institutions is a direct response to the discontinuance of funding artists in the 1960s. And so everybody needs to create an institution in order to get their work seen.
Right. The NEA has also announced that it's planning to give out fewer but bigger grants. Assuming that happens, how would that affect the theater companies that you nurture and oversee in rural North Carolina?
Well, I think that's a mistake. One of the suggestions that I made was that you should go in exactly the opposite direction. You should be not throwing large amounts of money at large institutions, but instead focusing micro grants to places where it will have a real impact. We've got an arts ecosystem that's really concentrated in, New York and Chicago and Los Angeles and a few other, Washington, D.C., Minneapolis.
Yeah.
And that's fine, but I think that they don't need any more fertilizer. We need it in South Dakota and Nebraska and, in other places that don't have these, where there is a lot of demand and not much supply.
You're obviously familiar with people doing rural theater, small town theater all over the country. How do they manage to pull it off, the ones who are pulling it off?
There's a theater in Washburn, Wisconsin, called Stage North. It has this gorgeous facility that overlooks Lake Superior, 160-seat auditorium, produce a play every month. They also have music in the lobby. They have a film festival every summer. They have a film and dance program. They have all of these sorts of things in a town of 2,000. The number of tickets that they sold last year is 10,000. So 5 tickets for every person in Washburn. To me, that makes them the epicenter of the American theater.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they're not even a nonprofit. They're a profit. They have operate on a profit organization. Yeah.
There's almost an expectation today that running a theater and certainly any kind of serious theater means, mm-hmm. This is going to be a deficit operation. So you're saying that's not necessarily so.
It's not necessarily so. And in fact, in the 1960s, the general idea was that all of the theaters would be self-sustaining and that it wouldn't be reliant too much on contributions. But then there was a study that came out in 1966 that basically said that's impossible, that the arts have not been able to take advantage of technological improvements, and consequently it still takes the same amount of musicians to play Beethoven's Ninth as it took
right.
back when Beethoven wrote it, and we can't cut it down. Hamlet takes the same number of actors. And at that moment, there seems to be evidence that that nonprofit organizations immediately started bleeding red ink. That given permission to run a deficit, they expanded their programs under the assumption that the Ford Foundation or the Rockefeller Foundation would bail them out as needed. And I think that pattern has continued to this day.
And the NEA was founded about that exact same time.
That's exactly right. And now we're in a situation where all of these organizations rely 50% on unearned income. I don't think that's sustainable, and I think that we saw that as soon when the economy tanked in the last 2 years,
right.
and suddenly the money started to run short.
Boy, your peers in the theater world are going to say once again that here he goes. If something like a death panel were created by Rocco Lenisman at the NEA and you were asked to serve on it, would it be easy to go through the theaters that exist that get NEA funds and say, no, no, yes, no, yes, no, no?
No, I don't think that it would be. One of the things that is used by the NEA in deciding who gets money, who doesn't, is something about quality. And right now, they see it as being part of the art object itself. It's a quality production. It's quality mm-hmm. directing. I think that actually the quality exists in the relationship between the production and the audience. And I think actually that is going to work against some of the larger institutions whose audience relationship has become a little sleepy. And I think that it would sort of even the playing field a lot more.
Yeah, although we can't deny that there are lesser and greater versions of Hamlet or Kiss Me, Kate or whatever it is.
I think that's right. On the other hand, you know, if you put a production of Hamlet in front of an audience that is not interested in Hamlet, I don't care how good it is, you don't
right.
have a living work of art.
Right.
And on the other hand, I have seen some, you know, really blatantly amateur productions that created this incredibly dynamic audience response that was because of a relationship between the house and the stage. And
right.
I think that should be rewarded.
Scott Walters, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Another opening, another show in Philly, Boston, or Baltimore. A chance for stage folks to say hello.
Another opening of another show.
Scott Walters is the director of the Center for Rural Arts Development and Leadership Education in Asheville, North Carolina.
Another pain where the ulcers grow.
Another opening of another show. 4 weeks you rehearse and rehearse. 3 weeks and it couldn't be worse. 1 week will it ever be right? And out of the hat is that big first night.
Even a super mega gigantic budget does not guarantee a work of art that works. Last week on the show, we heard about the very troubled Broadway production of Spider-Man, the musical. It's the most expensive show in history, $70 million and counting. And after 4 months of performances, it hasn't even officially opened. The producers just fired the director, Julie Taymor, and they're thought to be radically revamping the show now. We asked you to tell us, can Spider-Man be saved?
I'm Richard Daniels, and I live in New York City.
Richard was in the audience the infamous night that a performer fell 30 feet.
You'd been watching bodies fly all night long, and here was a body that fell with gravity, and the show instantly stopped. And then briefly after that, they said, okay, everybody go home. I don't think most of the people in the audience knew what had happened.
But Richard did know. He's a dancer and an avid theater goer. And he saw other problems, big problems with the show as well.
I knew that night what I would change. I would have cut some of the Arachne storyline. I would have cut the nerdy kids that I thought did absolutely nothing to advance the plot. I would have dropped some of the music. And
So you're not a fan of the music by Bono and The Edge?
Well, I thought it was boring. It just didn't seem to have the arc and the variety and the texture that you would sort of need from a musical stage piece.
Right.
But listen, it's not my baby, so I can say anything.
Exactly. So did you like anything about the show?
I thought that the special effects were phenomenal. The stage pictures were extraordinary. And I thought when that wasn't happening, that the show absolutely died. The story was lame.
Yeah, I agree with you 100% on all of your criticisms and what you thought was great. I mean, the stage pictures, as you call them, were so good that I at the end of the first act, I still had hope that it might recover and be good because there were moments in the first act where I thought, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Well, you know, they offered all of us tickets to come again. And I had my mother coming to town, and I thought, oh, let's get tickets far enough into the future that the show will be fixed.
Yeah.
And then a few days after we had our tickets to see the show again, they were going to close it down for retooling. We all sort of thought, I think we're over this now.
I can't disagree, but actually, I'm eager to see the revamped show. You can read Richard's full critique at studio360.org, and if you have an opinion about Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark, or even if you're over it like him, let us know. We really do love hearing from you. Coming up, a young Texas musician who is determined to make the blues cool again. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the redesigned Scion TC, featuring a 180-horsepower engine and responsive handling, giving you the power to maneuver today's congested cities. Get there at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Like most people my age, I think, I discovered blues music thanks to a few English guys. Keith Richards, Eric Clapton.
Could fill spoons full of diamonds. Could fill spoons full of gold.
But of course, they had discovered the blues from artists like Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters.
I'm ready. Ready than anybody.
With the blues, it's a slightly awkward fact that's just hard to get around. The musicians who invented it were black, but for the last four or five decades, the people playing it and listening to it have been largely white. Gary Clark Jr. is out to change that.
I had this kid tell me, you know, in high school, he's a young black guy, we played basketball together, and he said, why you play blues? He said, black people don't play blues. And I was like, what? You know, that's where it came from.
Clark is 27, a native of Austin, Texas, and he's been known there as a blues guitar prodigy since he was a teenager. Last week, he was one of thousands of musicians playing the city's ginormous national South by Southwest Festival.
It's cool. It's exciting. There's a lot of new people. The energy is undeniable. But, you know, it's like my normal bars I just walk into and, like, kick it, or I can't get into it this week. I'm not important anymore.
Clark established himself on the Austin music scene by playing at the legendary club Antone's. That's where Stevie Ray Vaughan and his brother Jimmy Vaughan played, white musicians who define modern Texas blues. Clark's music is classic, not some kind of fancy fusion hybrid. I don't think there's any big trick to getting young people back to the blues. It's just a matter of awareness.
The music has so much to offer. A lot of things have grown from that, and people aren't aware. Even in hip-hop, you know, a lot of samples, a lot of things. You know, what's a Wu-Tang song? You're hearing an Albert King lick, you know. It's like, where's that come from?
Dance with the mantis, no for slim chances. Chant this anthem, swing like Pete Sampras. Taking it straight to big man on campus. Brandish your weapon, don't get dropped to the campus.
The thing that I love about it is so simple. I mean, for the most part, when you think of a blues progression, there's been so many great stories told over that progression. It just kind of gets to the point without too many distractions.
When Clark played last Saturday night at South by Southwest, the cool kids ate it up. White, black, Latino, hipsters, indie rockers, jam banders.
Ain't got no money.
When he was starting out, even Clark's own friends needed some coaxing to appreciate his kind of music.
Because I shoved it down their throats. But no, it was funny growing up. They would always kind of ask me, like, "What? Why are you listening to blues? Why are you listening to that old sad music?" It's like, man, it's truth, you know, it's life. I think they get it now, you know, but it took them a while. They caught on, though.
Gary Clark Jr.'s record will be out later this year, but right now you can check out a video of him playing just for us at studio360.org. And while you're at our website, you can also see live performances by lots of other great musicians who've been on the show. That's studio360.org. Our only Tom Olad reported our story from Austin. In New York, it's finally spring, and so great to get outside again. There is no one more fun to walk around town with than Myra Kalman. Hi, Myra.
Hey, Kurt.
Walking around is where she gets a lot of her ideas. Myra is an artist who has illustrated tons of magazine covers, designed wristwatches and umbrellas, written a dozen books for kids, and produces a great visual blog for the New York Times website. The first museum retrospective of Myra Kalman's work has been traveling the country, and it's up now at New York's Jewish Museum.
Look at how these sneakers are shrink-wrapped or whatever.
Everywhere she goes, and she travels a lot, all kinds of unusual people in their hats and shoes and pets are constantly catching her eye, as well as stuff in shop windows.
Look at these ties. They undulate, they ripple, they're really, really gigantically ugly ties.
Myra loves to collect things, all kinds of things, suitcases, hats, balls of string, and she turns her finds into colorful, charming still life paintings, surrounded usually by prose written in her own loopy handwriting. Her work is funny and smart and heartwarming in the best sense. A couple of years ago, Myra and I went for a stroll, and I took her down to an old narrow lane in Lower Manhattan that is thick with odd old-school urban treasures, Nassau Street.
It seems like I've never been here before. I was really perplexed about how to get here.
So do you take an image idea gathering walk every day?
Many image ideas every day. I mean, I do two things. One, I take photos of many different things. And then I also have this thing where I tell myself I won't take the photo and I'll just run home and I'll draw the person. But I have to say to myself, like, you know, black hat, red coat, gray socks. And I have to say that over and over, like some kind of thing, so I won't forget. Wait a minute, we have to stop because there's a mattress. So I'm photographing all the mattresses on the street and all the sofas that are on the street. And there are a lot of them.
Oh, you've already, this is all part of the plan?
This is an ongoing collection. I have a lot of mattresses.
So you just snapped the picture, digital picture of this futon, I guess it is.
Oh, look, there's a hat store. Oh, my God.
This
Bonanza.
Is a collection. But before we leave the mattress idea, how many do you have?
Mattress, 50.
What will become of that collection?
It may be a painting or a collection of mattress photos that I put in some book about, you know, mattresses.
Here we are at Hat Corner.
It was established 1890. Oh, my God. This is really good. And the great thing about the hats is that you start looking at the names, the Detroit, the Kangol.
There's nothing in this window that couldn't have been here in 1960.
Right. I mean, that's actually what's so amazing about walking down the street is that there, you can't ever define the time you're in because there's somebody who's dressed in, plus fours, and there's somebody wearing a futuristic, you know, nylon Japanese, you know, not nylon, that's, that really dates me. It's nylon, it's amazing. Some kind of phenomenal
thing. Is that rayon?
Yeah. It's polyester, they just invented it.
No, here, so we have...
Anyway, so we have the
have
ivy.
Names, too.
Yeah.
The castro wool.
And, you know, like the pork pie. Let's go in.
You want to go in?
Ooh.
Ah, my shirt's
okay. Oh my God, you're wearing the, what is that?
Cossack.
Called the Cossack. Excuse me, my people were not happy with the Cossacks. So how long have you been here?
100 years.
You look very good.
Huh?
Yeah. What's the most popular hat now?
Stingy brim, small brim.
Stingy?
Really?
Yeah. You're calling it stingy?
Yeah.
Because it's small.
Well, that's for me too. I love a small brimmed hat. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
And of course, interestingly, the man we were speaking to in there, while he wasn't wearing a hat, was wearing a rather obvious toupee, which I guess is...
it's a head cover.
He's mad as a hatter. So let's keep walking down Nassau.
Dunkin' Donuts. Excuse me, we have to go into Dunkin' Donuts.
Okay. How long per day do you devote to this kind of scavenger hunt?
It depends how bored I am working in my studio. It could be a lot of the day.
Do you really want to go in Dunkin' Donuts?
Sure. Okay. We have to look at the names of the donuts. Well, you know, there's nothing better than a jelly donut. So they have Bavarian cream and they have Boston cream. Oh, no, we're not great. We're not getting any. We're just looking at them. Thanks.
It's the glazed, versions of the glazed things that I like. Bow ties.
And I love the bow tie. Yeah, the bow tie. And the claw and the cruller.
So you're not snobby about going to mass market franchise place like Dunkin' Donuts.
There's nothing too high or nothing too low, but...
You're taking me on a journey of discovery.
Yes, look at that rabbit.
What is it? It's a rabbit covered in pearls?
Pearls. I have to ask.
Okay.
Oh, it's a Chinese store. Oh, I see. They're animals. The animals. Hi. Well, I want to ask you about that rabbit covered in pearls. What is that?
This is a rabbit and with a rice pearl, handmade. It's a freshwater pearl. It's a very beautiful sculpture. Everything handmade.
Would you like a pearl-covered rabbit? Or not now.
Sort of, but I don't want to push
it. It's an interesting object.
Well, then there's a little
thank
pig.
We have tiger.
And
we have
pig.
Yeah, I see.
And we have
yeah.
something inside too, a donkey, a rooster.
Yeah, beautiful for Christmas gift.
Yeah.
Interesting well, story. I've been photographing rabbits a lot, but the rabbit is the one that appeals to me the most. But
this one's
$6.90 originally.
Well, look, here's Elizabeth Taylor covered with pearls. Yes. It's funny that you have that book. I have that book, too.
She collected. I like Princess Diana.
I can show you a quick look. I bring in.
Oh, no, thank you very much. It's very good, but we're going to be on our way.
Okay.
You might have to come back and get that rabbit.
Well, I'm going to have to photograph that rabbit. Oh, great. Thank
Thanks.
You very much.
Come back anytime.
We will.
This is called Tansy Tang.
Yeah.
I like your name.
This is a wonderful rabbit.
Thank you.
Nassau Rock and Nassau Road. Nassau's got a whole lot of soda.
Well, so, you know, at a certain point, you say, I've had enough of looking at the merchandise and the ephemera of selling, and I'm just going to go and stare at a tree for a couple of hours. That's usually the antidote for anything. But the other day I was walking up Madison Avenue and I stopped a woman who looked incredible, and I took a picture of her. She was strolling up, very well dressed, with a younger man, and he says to me, guess how old she is? And I said, I don't guess people's ages. And he said, 101, before I could even finish my sentence. So what I didn't have the presence of mind to do was to get her name and to say, I'd like to have tea with you every day for the rest of my life, but I'm going to try to find her. Hey, look, this is called No Style.
K-N-O-W. So you collect all this stuff day by day by day by day. Then do you just rely on your memory to say, oh, yeah, that bunny made of pearls by those nice Chinese women?
Yep, if I think that it's interesting a month or two or six from now. You know, the things that you keep coming back to are the things that obviously have made the biggest impression. So you can't know because things are fresh and you get all excited. Then you come back and you go like, whatever, wasn't that great. But, you know, while I'm taking pictures, I'm also making notes. And then usually I find a nice coffee shop to stop in and gather my thoughts. Coffee shops are key.
During one of these hikes, you stop at a coffee shop usually?
Always.
In fact, because this is a Roxy food shop, which looks like an old-fashioned diner.
Yeah, I like
sit it. Sit down, gather our thoughts, have a cup of coffee.
It's got a counter. It's
a counter
old,
with those stools. Okay.
Hello.
Oh. I'll have a cup of coffee.
Sandwiches from our grill and tasty. Hey, look, they have a sardine sandwich. I usually do a drawing of, you know, my coffee and my. It's like doing the thing, you know.
Thanks.
So there's your cup of coffee. Now I've done a drawing of it and a photo of it. Or I wanted to do a painting of it.
This place, except for the energy saving fluorescent lights, like that hat shop, could be, you know, this would have been no different 45 years ago.
Right. Okay, so now I'm going to take a picture. Kurt, I'm going to take a picture of you with your coffee cup.
So is this more or less like it happens when I'm not following you along?
Yeah, this is it. This is it. This is all that happens. Not much.
But everything, too. Thank you for letting me tag along.
Thanks, Kurt. I'm going to stay here and order a couple of cheeseburger
good.
Deluxes.
Well, they look pretty good.
It never gets boring to watch people make food.
At Studio360.org, you can see some photos from our walk, as well as images from Myra's show at New York's Jewish Museum, which is called Various Illuminations of a Crazy World. Efron's movie, You've Got Mail, chronicled one of the David versus Goliath battles of the 1990s. Independent bookstores being put out of business by mega chains. Tom Hanks played Goliath.
Do you know what? We are going to seduce them with our square footage and our discounts and our deep armchairs and
our cappuccino.
That's right. They're going to hate us at the beginning, but
we'll get them in the air.
Well, yes, some of them, but that was then. Now, the chain bookstores are the ones being got. Borders just filed for bankruptcy, and Barnes & Noble's stock dropped 50% in the last month. We are suddenly, really, in the age of the downloadable ebook. Amazon now sells more Kindle books than any other format. So now, no brick-and-mortar bookstore is really safe. Studio 360's Eric Molinsky looked into some survival strategies.
It would be nice to think in this latest round of bookstore wars, the scrappy independents came out on top. But this isn't the first time the industry is going through a shakeup, and it won't be the last.
We didn't used to call them independent bookstores. They were just bookstores. We didn't even need the label.
Clay Shirky's a professor at NYU who studies how the internet is changing society.
If we're concerned about books, we're in paradise right now because the average resident of Missoula, Montana has access to more of the world's literature now than the average resident of Greenwich Village did 20 years ago.
20 years ago, there were 5,000 independent bookstores in the U.S. Now there are less than 2,000. But the numbers leveled out last year. According to the American Booksellers Association, there's even been some growth. Chuck Robinson is the former president of the ABA, and he runs Village Books in Bellingham, Washington.
In a couple of places around the country, I know that indies have gone in to take over spaces that have been either Borders stores or Walden stores or Borders Express stores, trying to reestablish a foothold in those places.
While those indies may be taking over empty stores, the hard part these days is just getting customers into the store. Chuck Robinson is pulling out all the stops. His store is open late for author events. They're constantly sending out tweets and updating their status on Facebook. If you prefer to read electronic books, they sell those too. You can download them from the store's website to your Nook or your Sony e-reader, just not the Kindle.
Unfortunately, right now, Kindle doesn't support the Google e-books and likes to keep the business for themselves, I guess.
Their biggest investment is an espresso machine. No, not that espresso machine. That was like the 90s, and they already have a cafe. The espresso book machine is a $100,000 piece of equipment that downloads text, prints it up, and binds a book for you right there in the store. It takes about 5 minutes.
It's basically two $20,000 printers with the Middle Ages in between.
It's Clay Shirky again.
One giant Xerox machine printing out hundreds of pages, and this other beautiful thing printing glossy covers. And then in the middle, there are these giant knives and glue wells that operate in this kind of automated way, and the process hasn't changed much since Gutenberg.
But the espresso machine's real benefit may be the way it helps foster community. Village Books, Chuck Robinson's store, has become like a tiny publishing house for local authors to distribute books among friends and colleagues.
One is about, the title is Coma Culsion. It's the story of Mount Baker, which is the Cascade Mountain that's very close to Bellingham. Another is one about Fairhaven, the historic district in which we're located. I wrote a book about the 30 years of our history of the bookstore in 2010. That was our number 8 bestseller in the store.
A book about his bookstore made in his bookstore. That's local. But Clay Shirky thinks if bookstores are going to survive, they have to move beyond the idea that they're the best place to buy books. Brick-and-mortar stores of all kinds are going out of business because it's just easier to buy things online. And that means a lot of the empty stores on Main Street will remain empty.
I think if we lose the way that street-level commerce actually causes neighbors to run into each other, cities become less good places to live.
Well, this is where bookstores have something unique to offer. Now, forget you've got mail. Think about when Harry met Sally. Where did Harry re-meet Sally 10 years later and start their friendship and romance? Not a bar, not a cafe. They were browsing in a bookstore.
Someone is staring at you in personal growth.
I know him.
Sally Milburn.
Hi, Harry.
I thought it was you.
It is.
If you and I are both in the poetry section and those people over there are both in the physics section, the bookstore is actually aggregating people who may have something more in common with one another than if those people were just passing each other on the street.
So in the future, bookstores may exist mainly as places to meet people. That's one reason why Housing Works Bookstore in Manhattan is so popular.
We do one-time-only events that are, you know, these unique collaborations between different artists, and that if you come see something here, it's going to be, you know, an experience that you can't get anywhere else.
That's Vice President Susie Lupert. Not only do they host star-studded readings, pairing rock stars with authors that were inspired by each other's work, but their staff likes being in the store so much. Most of them are volunteers.
They shelve all of our books, they deal with incoming donations, they make the lattes, they clean, they help set up for events, they stay till midnight. every day we sell over 400 books online. They come in and they pick every one of those books off the shelves and they pack them in envelopes and they help us ship them out. I mean, it's astounding.
Now, Housing Works is not your typical bookstore. They sell used books. Half their business comes from online sales, and that money goes towards a nonprofit, which helps homeless people with AIDS. They thrive on a kind of do-gooderness. But a lot of what really gets people through the front door is just the appeal of the space itself. Located off a narrow cobblestone street in Soho, it perfectly captures the idea of a bookstore.
There are these sort of, you know, curved staircases up to this mezzanine level of beautiful shelves.
It reminds them of something. It reminds them of an old movie, or it reminds them of the bookstore that they always thought that they wanted, or it reminds them of the library in their hometown.
There really is a kind of temple of books-like feeling about it.
As more and more people are choosing to download electronic books from the comfort of their home, Clay Shirky thinks that all bookstores may have to embrace the Housing Works model sooner or later and become nonprofits themselves.
We may even have to stop calling them bookstores. We may have to start calling them, you know, literary environments where people who self-consciously care about written expression come together.
It will be an event space and a rental facility and a cafe with books as a nostalgic backdrop for people to browse through and not buy.
So I guess in the future we can expect bookstore memberships, matching grants, pledge drives, tote bags. Sound familiar? For Studio 360, I'm Eric Molinsky.
Sure, you love independent bookstores, and so do I. But where do you really buy your books? We want to know. Physical stores or online? And why do you like going to where you go? We've got a survey at studio360.org. Coming up, some life advice from the songwriter Randy Newman.
Laugh and be happy. Don't you ever wear a frown. Don't let the bastards grind you down.
Randy Newman performs live in our studio. That's ahead in a minute. You're listening to Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with
now
us.
Now the country that we're living in, you mean the good old USA, that's right. It's never been about keeping you out. It's about inviting you in and letting you play, so laugh and be happy.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the redesigned Scion TC, featuring a 180-horsepower engine and responsive handling, giving you the power to maneuver today's congested cities. Get there at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. If you've seen a Pixar movie in the last decade or so, and woe to you if you haven't, chances are about even that you heard this guy singing.
Don't you turn your back on me. Don't you walk away.
Randy Newman has composed the scores for Monsters, Inc., A Bug's Life, Meet the Parents, and he just won an Oscar for this song, which he wrote for Toy Story 3.
We belong together. We belong together. Yes, we do.
But those of us of a certain age know Randy Newman from an earlier incarnation as the cheerfully dark, sometimes satirical, folksy, rootsy singer-songwriter.
Has anybody seen me lately? I'll tell you why. Has anybody seen me lately? I'll tell you why. A cop some made me so sick that I thought that I would die. And almost did, too.
Back in 2008, he put out an album called Harps and Angels. It came out after a 9-year hiatus from making records. And I wonder, what took him so long?
Apparently, I don't write unless I have to. In movies, you have to wake up in the morning, and while you're awake, you have to be working.
So what made you have to?
Well, it's been so long.
Oh,
I mean,
so just
9 years, it's inexcusable. If I want to set a good example for my kids, I'd like them to work have some kind of work habits, and I don't have any.
You've written about 10 movies in the last decade.
I haven't done much. I mean, my cousin Tom's done more.
Thomas
James
Newman.
James Newton Howard does 4 or 5 a year.
So I guess if it had gone to a full decade, some alarm bell would go off in your...
Well, I mean, it really did. And I actually had a record company who wanted a record from me. I mean, it's not like the kids are waiting for the new Newman to come out. They weren't there at midnight. Though this record is doing very well. So, I mean, for me, I mean, it's a hit. They could stop right now.
Before we talk some more, I'd love it if you'd play a song.
Sure.
From the new album, Laugh and Be Happy.
Yeah, I will. Which is sort of about immigration, more or less. I know what's going on here. Ain't no great mystery. Y'all have lost faith in yourself. As clear as it can be. You can whine all you want to. Drown in your misery. You can listen to me. Listen to me. Laugh and be happy. Don't you ever wear a frown. Don't let the bastards grind you down. Laugh and be happy, it's a simple thing to do. Believe in your dream, and your dream will come true for you. There's a red sun shining in a sky so blue. Blackbirds singing in the trees. There's a real silver lining up there for me and you. Listen to me, listen to me. And be happy, smile right in our face, 'cause pretty soon you're gonna take our place. Come on, whack, whack, whacking like old man trouble, whacking on that front door. We're gonna send you back and on the double, but you ain't going away no more. Laugh and be happy. Don't you ever wear a frown. Get right back on your feet. Whenever they knock you down, you got to laugh and be happy. Smile right in their feet. Everything is gonna go your way. You'll be on top of the world.
That's Randy Newman performing Laugh and Be Happy here in Studio 360. When you write songs with a in some kind of political, social message, do you think of it as trying to affect the way listeners think, or?
I do think that way, but I mean, I know that it doesn't. I mean, no one's going to say, oh my God, I've been a horrible bigot all my life. How have I done? Randy Newman, oh, thank you. I'm not a bigot anymore.
Do you have a process for writing songs? Okay, you decided, God, I got to write a record.
I have to, yeah. I sit at the piano and wait to have an idea. I'll play something, they'll give me, short people got, for some reason, that's where I'll go.
Right.
But it'll always be music first, and then it'll initiate something, either a voice, and syntax, or just the way the guy talks will indicate where the song goes to some extent.
Speaking of short people, when that came out in 1978 or when I Love L.A. out in 1983, as you had those ideas, did you say, man, these are going to be hits?
No, I didn't think so. I just knew I needed an up song for the album. It was a lot of ballad type things.
And so you decided for an up song to talk about somebody who has people who have no reason to live.
Yeah, but I mean, it was so excessive and so exaggerated that I couldn't believe that anyone was bothered by it. The song's about a lunatic, just like, political science is. I mean, no one likes us. I don't know why. We may not be perfect, but heaven knows we try. All around, even our old friends put us down. Let's drop the big one and see what happens. Now,
I used to sing along with that so many times.
Yeah, but I mean, no one's that crazy. I mean, there have been Americans who are way to the right, jingoistic Americans who really think you know, hate Europeans even and everybody, but they don't want to drop bomb on anybody. This guy's crazier than anyone.
You come from this whole family of film composers, kind of an amazingly huge family of film composers, and you were doing it as a young man. But how, a dozen years ago, did you become one of Pixar's go-to people?
John Lasseter asked me to do Toy Story.
Who's the head creative
guy? The head guy at Pixar. I think there were people that didn't want me to do it because, I mean, I'm as far from being kid-friendly in some of this stuff as you can be. I mean, I wrote some of the roughest stuff that was written lyrically before rap, you know, language-wise and every other way. But, I mean, he thought, maybe from my film music, that I could do these pictures. And I didn't know whether I could myself.
How does it strike you now, being this sort of bifurcated guy who, as you say, has done these rough, provocative, strange, quirky songs as a singer-songwriter, and then whom everybody under 30 or 25 knows as, oh, he's the guy from these movies. Is that—
you know, what I mainly am is a songwriter. And I commit myself to what the job is. And I have no feeling that I'm writing down to anyone ever. People who make movies often make the mistake of being condescending toward their audience and saying, you know, make sure the music comes in here to let them know that's a joke. Pixar doesn't.
Well, one of the but, I was going to say,
they know that they get the jokes.
One of the reasons Pixar movies are so good is exactly that they don't talk down to people.
No, they don't. Their characters are adults. You know, in the ones I did, Toy Story, you know, Woody, Mr. Potato Head. I mean, they're grown-ups.
Yeah.
And when they feel something, it's real. I take it seriously. It's strange to be talking about how Mr. Potato Head feels about Etch-a-Sketch, you know, and things like that, you know, for 10 minutes. But you do it. You know.
My producers tell me that they have uncovered a clip about you from the animated series Family Guy.
Yeah.
I haven't heard that.
This place is paradise.
Sure is. Except for Randy Newman.
Randy Newman?
Yep. Just sits there all night and day, singing about what he sees.
Fat man with his kids and dog. Drove in through the morning fog. Hey there, Rover. Come on over.
Well, it's nice to have music while we eat.
Red-headed lady. Reaching for an apple. Gonna take a bite. Nope. She takes a bite. Chews it once, twice, three times, four times. Stops. Saliva working. Take the long, hard look.
Now that is a lot of airtime devoted to a parody of Randy Newman.
Yeah. But, you know, it isn't a bad song. It's got things rhyming, you know, that are pretty good.
And it, and it goes in this strange way with this strange syncopation?
You know, same three chords that I use. It isn't the type of writer I am, you know, descriptive of what's around me.
Right.
But I am literal in that sense when given an assignment. But it's nice that they'd heard me enough to do it. You know, I'm not bothered by it. The fact that it is the biggest impact I've made in 64 years.
Is that really true?
Yeah, I think so. No, Randy Newman, Family Guy. There's a lot of kids and friends of my younger kids who know me from that.
Yeah. Well, weren't you, I mean, in a different way because it was your song. When Short People became such a massive hit, weren't you a little ambivalent about the fact that that was the thing that everyone knew?
It's a bad break to have, you know, it's always a good break to have a hit, but it was like a novelty hit. It was like a fad for a couple weeks, you know, sports. I'd be watching a ball game and one guy in the booth would be teasing the other guy in the booth. And it was a hit that didn't help me sell records, draw people. I mean, if you could have a hit that hurt your career... That was it.
Although now it's settled into a kind of vintage thing.
Yeah,
right?
Now it'll still be the first sentence of my obituary, you know, and composer of Short People.
Maybe not first.
Winner
sentence.
Of the Academy Award, which was for a song that, you know, is less than my best.
Randy Newman, thanks very much for coming in.
That was a great pleasure. Time went by fast.
Will you play us out with a song?
Yeah, I'll play something. Let's see. Let me see, what haven't I done? Korean parents for sale. You say you're not all that you want to be. You say you got a bad environment. Work at school's not going well. Korean parents for sale. You say you got a little discipline. Someone to whip you into shape. They'll be strict, but they'll be fair. Look at the numbers. That's all I ask. Who's at the head of every class? Do you really think they're smarter than you are? They just work their asses off. Their parents make them do it.
The Randy Newman Songbook Volume 2 comes out next month. And at Studio360.org, you can hear a song that he played here just for us. And that is it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening. We'll have a new show for you next week, but in the meantime, check out our website, our Facebook page, and our Twitter feeds. We've got new arts and pop culture updates for you every single day. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Michael Guerriero,
Sarah D'Elia,
Katie Palmer,
Mary Du.
And thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
PRI Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. And by Scion, presenting the redesigned Scion TC, featuring a 180-horsepower engine and responsive handling, giving you the power to maneuver today's congested cities. Get there at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, playwright Gregory Burke isn't exactly what you'd call a peacenik.
Being anti-war, I think that's a kind of a misnomer in a way, because, you know, you're as well saying I'm anti-human as anti-war, because, you know, warfare, you know, has always existed as long as humans have existed.
That's Gregory Burke on his play Black Watch. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.